Hello, hello, hello. This is the Saturday Night Live Day of Sobriety number 20, held at El Paseo Shopping Center, room 120, in San Jose, California, on May 28th, 1993. Our main speaker at 2 p.m. will be, well, it is Diane W., and I'm sure she's already spoken since you're listening to it. The original recording and its copy are at the SNL Tape Library. Please observe the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous and do not play this recording for commercial or entertainment purposes. And please do not break the anonymity of the speakers or any AA member at the public level. Thank you very much.
My name is Diane and I'm an alcoholic. Hi there. My home group is Living in a Solution in San Mateo, California. A moment of process here. I didn't realize I was supposed to talk for an hour, and I had some difficulty in my feelings about speaker only names. I am grateful to be able to be here today, and I'm grateful to have been asked. I'm not sure in live with honesty that I can say I'm grateful to be here. I used to be a really different kind of person. I found out when I got sober that many of the people I considered my closest friends had not been sharing with me that they were afraid of me. I had a lot of history of people who were afraid of me. It turns out that I had a really sharp tongue. I still do, it's just that I don't use it quite as often as I used to. That I seemed angry all the time, and that I was very difficult to deal with. It took me several years into recovery to begin to realize that I might have changed, and I still carry around some of that baggage with me. I used to tell people that I was a very shy person. Most people who know me now consider that statement hilarious. I'm really not shy at all. I carried with me throughout my life and into recovery some things that happened in my childhood that were sort of central, that were the issues that I continue to deal with, and many of them I'm grateful to say I think I dealt with well, and have put many of them behind me. My father died when I was 5 months old, and that has always affected the way I approach the world. I wasn't ever bothered. My mother remarried when I was 6 years old to your basic anal retentive macho authoritarian bastard. And he and I never became close. I took with me into adulthood, or what passed for adulthood, the absolute conviction that men were creatures from a totally different planet with a different agenda, and that there were very few excuses for them being allowed to be alive. And those few excuses, they rarely fulfilled well. The process of recovery has helped me through that. And today I have what I call friends who happen to be male. The household I grew up in probably will seem very familiar to many of you. We had very careful conversations. There was always an explosion that we were trying to suppress. The phrases that I grew up with that I remember are phrases like, "Wipe that expression off your face. You don't really feel that way." And do what I tell you, not what I do. What I gained from that, I had to, in the process of inventory, look at what I came out of that with. And in all honesty, there were a number of positive things that I gained from that. I bring to my life a conviction that you get, to some extent, what you work for, that nothing is given to you free. And while many gifts are given to us in recovery, they are graces from God and not a matter of luck. They're sort of beyond the thing. The things that I want in my life, I have to work for and do the footwork for. It's the things that I never knew I wanted that are the gifts of recovery to me and the graces in my life. I learned a certain amount of respect for authority, but I also learned through experience that authority can be frequently wrong, but it still needs to be respected for what it is. I learned a number of other things that I've grown to know are not true. I learned that my feelings weren't valid. I learned that I was a worthless individual whose value today depended on meeting some set of criteria today. That set of criteria was never reachable. And that no matter what I did, it was never good enough. I learned that the people I wanted to love me could not be counted on to be there. Those were really damaging things, and I've had to learn that they weren't true. And to me, that's what recovery was all about. My family, if we want to call it that, moved a lot. When I graduated from high school, it was my 17th school, and I was at my 32nd address. I used to be able to remember them all, and I can't. But that also contributed to a feeling that there was not a network of people around me. People were disposable. They were sort of temporarily here. They weren't a big part of my life because I was convinced that they were always going to go away, or I would go away, which amounts to the same thing. If I had to, when I first came to recovery, sort of do a list and describe myself, one of the most painful things I had to do in early recovery was list the good things about myself. And it was a short list. I was smart, I was courageous, and I was strong. That was the entire list. And I lived my whole life until I got sober trying to be smart and courageous and strong. And if the situation didn't call for me to be smart or courageous or strong, I created situations that called for it. I moved a lot, which is what I had learned to do in childhood. I changed jobs every 2 years. I got into inappropriate relationships and inappropriate work situations. And there was always some sort of crisis that I was fighting myself out of. At one point in my early 20s, I came out of yet another unfulfilling relationship with this human being that I didn't understand because he was male. And my solution to that at that time was to say I needed a challenge. And so what I did was move to New York City on the theory that surviving in New York City for a year would be an accomplishment that I could point to. It was in New York City that I got over my shyness. In my late teens, there was a period in my family where my mother drank a lot. My mother always worked very, very hard. My mother had this attitude that all men are bastards. I recall one of her, she's been married 5 times, and which to some extent explains why I have been married no times. And I recall a bunch of us driving to Reno with my mother and her prospective husband. We were going to get them married off. And mother was full of starry eyes and hope for the future. And we drove to Reno and checked into a motel room, and they changed clothes, and we went to dinner, and they went and got married. They got married, then we went to dinner. And then we drove home. And in the car on the way back, this paradigm that my mother had chosen to spend the rest of her life with turned into that bastard. And he stayed that bastard until the marriage ended a year later. I learned that my mother was not a good source of information about relationships with men. I did very, very well in school, and I got almost all of my self-esteem from that. I did very, very well in work situations, and I got almost all my self-esteem from that. Because my mother drank a lot, and because I had an opportunity to see her when she was drunk and when she was crying and when she was full of self-pity, I knew that I didn't want to be like that. And so I didn't drink. I would occasionally have a social drink, but I found that when I began to feel it, it made me very, very nervous. The one thing that I had going for me in my life was my control over myself and over the world around me, and alcohol took that away. And so it made me very, very nervous. I would go to parties, I would have a drink or two, and then I would head to the kitchen and I would make coffee and drink coffee for the rest of the evening. I would have a lot of fun at parties. When I moved to New York City, I went into a different social culture, and I was 3,000 miles away from my family and my home and everyone that I had ever known, and things began to change a little bit. I was living in Midtown Manhattan. I was working on Wall Street. It was sort of my teenage vision of the independent woman in the late 60s. And one of the things I did when I was in New York City was discover that perhaps part of the problem with the social drinking I had attempted to do was that it was geared around things like scotch and 7-Up. And that when I discovered straight scotch, or when I discovered vodka martinis, which were not sweet and icky drinks, the drinking became more palatable. It became a more pleasant experience. And I discovered that I liked the taste of alcohol. I still wasn't crazy about the notion of getting drunk and losing control. It made me very nervous. Those few occasions that I recall where I got drunk and embarrassed myself were really mortifying and terrible experiences for me. But at some point, I decided that it would be really sophisticated and wonderful if, when I came home from a hard day on Wall Street, while I was fixing my dinner in my $95 a month studio apartment in Manhattan, tells you how long ago that was, that I would pour myself a scotch and water while I fixed my drink. So I bought a bottle of scotch and I brought it home. And sometime later, I realized that from the time I brought that first bottle of scotch home, that it was 17 years before I went another day without a drink. I didn't drink a lot. I didn't drink a lot at parties. But every day I had a drink. And over the years, every day I had one drink, every day I had two drinks, five, ten. And 17 years later, I was drinking a quart of vodka a day. But it wasn't affecting my life, and I could quit any time I wanted. I became an alcoholic the hard way. I drank myself into it. When I came back from New York City, this was the late 60s. I had been trying to make my way in the world. The theme of my life was, it's me against the world and there's no one else who cares. And that was very difficult to do in the late 60s because I kept going to work for companies where I would ask questions about the way the business operated and would literally be patted on the head and told not to worry my pretty little head about it. For a strong, courageous, intelligent woman, this is not the way to go. And I came back to San Francisco at the height of the beginning of the feminist women's movement in San Francisco, and I got involved in that, mostly because I was really pissed off. And I used to defend the women's movement by saying it wasn't a lot of angry women, but on a lot of levels we were angry. It is also true that on a lot of levels we had every right to be angry. Part of my history is getting involved in organizations and trying to fix them. Since I never had husbands that I could fix, I fixed organizations. And so I got involved with the National Organization for Women in San Francisco for several years and became a public spokeswoman for the women's movement. And those of you who watch Channel 5 from time to time may see me popping up saying outrageous things about men. I wish to remind you that that was a long time ago and I'm a much nicer person now. The women's movement at the time was in its infancy. It was still coming to maturity. And its meetings, like any kind of organizational business meetings, heads up those of you involved in general service, were frequently either boring or contentious. And I found that the attitude of the women in the organization towards me was evenly split. Those who thought that I was the greatest thing since the Virgin Mary had come along. And those who thought that I was a dire threat to the movement, capital T, capital M. So it was difficult going into these meetings that I was chairing, and I discovered that three or four straight scotches before a meeting, and Robert's Rules of Order really came to mind. I went into my phase of drinking. It was this sort of a real shift where I found that I could drink almost everyone in the room under the table, and I thought it was kind of neat. I really liked the taste. It made me kind of loose, made me a little less nervous about things, and I was in total control of things while people around me were dropping like flies. I shudder now when I begin to think of what that did to my liver, and what that meant in terms of my susceptibility to the disease of alcoholism, but at the time it seemed like a wonderful gift to be able to drink just about as much as I wanted to. One of the things several years later that really disturbed me was when what began to happen to me is what happens to many of us, where I would have one drink and not know if I was going to be just fine, thank you, or if one drink was going to make me pass out on the floor. It's that level of uncertainty that's always terrible for alcoholics. It's easier, I mean, if you know one drink is going to make you pass out, you can prepare for it. It's just not knowing that's difficult. The next 10 years of my life or so can be summarized by doing the same things over and over and over again. I got into inappropriate relationships with inappropriate men. I moved from town to town, sometimes following inappropriate relationships with inappropriate men, sometimes following jobs, and sometimes just out of the absolute conviction that in another location my life would turn around and everything would be wonderful. I did the same. I took the same attitudes to the same situations and simply changed the characters in the play. But the script was the same. I woke up sometime around the age of 40 or 41, realizing, horror of horrors, that I was 40 or 41 years old, that a good portion of my life, even though I considered myself a bright and young up-and-comer, I had come up quite a ways along the way, and there was still a long way to go, and things didn't seem to be getting any better. I also began to have these other strange symptoms, this is sort of the last 5 years of my drinking kind of lumped in together. I began to notice things about myself. I began to notice that when people at work would say, "Let's go out to lunch, how about we go to Sammy's place?" I would say, "You know, I don't like Sammy's. The food there is not very good." When in fact the situation was that Sammy's didn't serve liquor. I began to notice that friends would ask me, "We're going to go to a movie at 2 o'clock on Saturday. You want to go?" I'd say, "No, I don't think so." Because 2 o'clock was a real bad time. It was, you can't go until 2 o'clock without drinking. But there isn't time to sort of get up and have a couple of drinks and then get straight before you go. So it was, you know, I was okay with 7. Because I could drink during the day and then kind of lay off for a couple of hours. And I was okay with 10 in the morning because I could drink afterwards. But 2 o'clock was a real tough time. I began to notice that every man that I was involved with, although he seemed wonderful when I first met him, turned out, oddly enough, to be an alcoholic. You know, I never quite understood why I didn't notice that these men were still alcoholics. They would, you know, show up drunk, they would not show up, they would pass out in the middle of the evening. It really didn't quite occur to me until sometime later that they were just drinking as much as I was. It was just that the effect on them was different. I began to be really terribly depressed. I had some few dysfunctional things going on in my life that caused me some distress, and it certainly was no fault of my own. I had this fear of the mailbox. There was this absolute conviction that there was some terrible thing in the mailbox and that if I opened it up, disaster would befall. And that had several results. One is that mailmen, I think, grew to hate me. I broke locks on mailbox doors because when they get so full, they kind of spring open and the landlord had to repair it. That became embarrassing, and so what I would do would get the mail out of the mailbox and throw it on the sofa, where it sort of grew a life of its own. I don't know. I did notice at that time in my life that at that point in time, they changed the rules now, so it's, I think it's been a couple of years since I've had cards to notice, but at that point in time, PG&E sent the cutoff notice in a blue envelope. So my strategy was, if it wasn't blue, I didn't need to open it. I paid my PG&E bill about three times a year. The phone company is much more liberal. I paid it about two times a year. I developed strategies for finding out if the lights and power had been cut off. At one place I lived, the bathroom was over the carport. So if I was afraid they were going to shut off the power, I would leave the bathroom light on when I left in the morning. That way, when I came home at night, as I pulled into the carport, I could tell if the power had been cut off. Now, going to that, I don't know why it never occurred to me to pay a bill, but it didn't. At some point in sobriety, I'm sure that you've heard this before, but I heard someone share at a meeting that the way that you get over the fear of bill collectors calling you and knocking at the door, and the way you get over the fear of them shutting off the lights, is that you pay the bill. And it's like, it's such a simple solution. I found myself in work situations surrounded by people who were hostile and unfriendly, mostly because they thought I was hostile and unfriendly, and I was. I worked for 9 years in the retail business. I worked for what we call a major department store, where I became a senior executive. I was really proud of myself. And there's a term that's used in that industry. It's called a classic retail bitch, and I was one. But I had early basic training. I mean, I worked my way into that category. And at one place I worked where I was the boss, they called me the dragon lady, and my way of dealing with that was I bought a little stuffed dragon and put it on my desk. I thought that would humanize me. And I was really hurt a lot that people thought that I was that kind of person, because I really was this very shy, nice, vulnerable little human being who just happened to bite people's heads off a lot. People were constantly coming up to me and saying, "What are you mad about?" And I would say, "What do you mean mad? I'm not mad about anything." What had happened was that somewhere back in my childhood, I had just kind of stuffed all that stuff and never dealt with it. And when I got sober, I had 35 years worth of anger and resentment and stuff to deal with that I didn't even know was there. Somewhere around my 40th or 41st birthday, in one of those outings that I agreed to go on, it was a friend's birthday, there were about 15 of us who went out to dinner to celebrate this friend's birthday. It was the one clear occasion where I can remember we had drinks before dinner and wine with dinner and after dinner drinks. And I can remember at that party saying to people, "You guys finished that?" Didn't really matter what they were drinking. I just couldn't stand to see a drink sitting there. And so I would finish it. I mean, you can't let it go to waste. And as we left that party, we were celebrating a friend's 60th birthday at that time, and we were a little bit worried about her. She'd had quite a bit to drink, and we were worried about how she was going to get home. She got home just fine, but I got arrested for drunk driving on the way home, which was a stunning shock, because I was about as drunk as I was every day of my life. I mean, this is just the way I lived. Somewhere around the 1.2, 1.4 alcohol level was the comfort zone. I never drank in the morning. My job was very important to me, which probably explains why I was so cranky in the mornings, but it just never occurred to me to drink in the morning, because that's what alcoholics did, and I didn't do that. So I got to go spend several hours at the Redwood City Women's Facility. How many of you have been there? Nice place. It was my first real brush with the state of California in a criminal capacity. And I wasn't terribly impressed. But on the other hand, I was drunk. I mean, how bad could it be? I do recall sharing a cell with a woman who I really felt sorry for, because she was a teacher and had been caught with some small amount of marijuana, kind of hashish or something. They stopped her for a taillight, and I don't know what she did to it, in their face or whatever. And she was worried about losing her teaching credential. And I was real grateful that I didn't have that problem. It was just a drunk driving arrest, you know. So I went home and sort of had to deal with that a little bit. And in the course of dealing with it, I dealt with it the way I dealt with everything else in my life at that point, which was pretty much to ignore it. And over the course of the next several months, I was depressed, I was fearful of the phone, I was fearful of the door, I considered killing myself, not necessarily because of the drunk driving, but just because of the general unawareness of where my life was going. You know, in order to try to pull myself, remember, this is the strong, courageous, independent person, in order to try to pull myself out of that, for a Christmas present that year, I gave myself a book that was written by someone, which was the story of people who had managed to turn their lives around, a book called The Courage to Change. And in the course of reading that book, it occurred to me that I probably really wasn't an alcoholic, because we all know what alcoholics are. And I wasn't one. But that certainly alcohol was a problem in my life. And so sort of on a technicality, I could call myself an alcoholic. And I could consider whether or not recovery from the disease of alcoholism would kind of help me get my life together a little bit and let me get a little more comfortable. And I shared that with a friend, sort of the first step of admitting something terrible about myself, that I thought I was an alcoholic. This was the woman who drank with me, drink for drink pretty much, and she said, nah, you're not an alcoholic. But she shared, as women tend to do, if one of us tells the other something in confidence, we tend to share it with other people who care about that person. I think it's okay. And one of the people she shared this with was a woman whose husband had recently gotten sober. And I had personal experience with what an obnoxious drunk dick was. And so it was really impressive to me that he had managed to get sober and that on his wife's testimony, life was better. And after talking it over with him, they offered to me his copy of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was really touched that someone would care enough to put that much thought into it and to give me something. And determined to try to make my life better, I sat down and began reading the Big Book. And I got to the chapter to the agnostic. And with a great deal of sadness and some amount of anger, I put the book down and said, this is another one of those fundamentalist Christian organizations that probably can't help me, because I tended to believe that religion, and in particular Christianity, was sort of a crutch for weak people. So then I said, okay, I can't do that. I mean, this was at the beginning of the period of time when we were seeing, you know, Hill Street Blues, and everybody was getting sober, you know, on television. And so we knew about AA meetings, and the impression I got from watching all those shows and from watching, you know, Days of Wine and Roses and that was that AA meetings were meetings of, you know, sort of 70-year-old men in $70 suits in church basements, and which, when I got sober, was not far from the truth. So I didn't really feel like I wanted to go to an AA meeting and find out, and then I read the Big Book and I said, eh, so what am I going to do? Well, I talked to Dick, and I said, how did he get sober? Well, he went to a treatment facility. And that really appealed to me, the idea of going to a hospital where I could kind of check in, bring some novels along, you know, get a rest. And 30 days later, I check out, and they fixed me. You know, it just seemed like a wonderful... So I didn't ask a lot of questions about what the process was, because I just wanted to turn my will and my life over to some hospital treatment program and let them do the work. But I put it off. Procrastination was another thing, like opening the mail. You know, I will get to it sometime, honestly. So I was sort of considering how I was going to do this, and I had to do it sometime, but there was plenty of time. Well, in the meantime, life played one of these little tricks on me. I was driving to work one morning in my car that didn't have insurance, with unregistered tags, with a driver's license where I hadn't changed the address for 4 years, when a couple of San Mateo City cops who were getting ready to go off duty thought that they could make a nice little score last thing in the morning, and they pulled me over to talk about my automobile registration. And then they ran the thing they do. I don't know. I'm not a big criminal, folks. And discovered that there was a warrant out for my address, my arrest for failure to appear, because when I had gone to court for my drunk driving, they did this thing about, well, you can pay the fine today, or we can send you little things in the mail that you will pay on a monthly basis. And for some reason at the time, that occurred to me to be a real good idea. It's just that I never opened the mail. And the courts kind of frowned on that, and it was just a matter of not sending in this money, but they called it failure to appear and had a warrant out for my address, arrest. So at 7 o'clock in the morning, these policemen were very upset because they thought this was going to take about 10 minutes and they could go home. And it wasn't. It turned into this big deal that they had to take me down and book me and then take me to the Redwood City Women's Facility again. And the difference this time was, A, I had some inclination that I might have a problem with alcohol, and B, it was 7 o'clock in the morning. It had been a good 8-9 hours since I'd had a drink. And I was about as sober as I was going to get. I have to admit that I'm really lucky. I'm really always have been protected and cared for. I was in a position to call someone at 8 o'clock in the morning and say I need $1,200 to get bailed out. So I sort of got to stand there in this little room where they fingerprint you. They didn't put me in a cell or anything. They just said, you know, nice, middle class looking lady. You going to be bailed? Okay, fine. You know, I didn't look like a hardcore criminal. So I got to stand there for 4 hours and look at everyone else in the jail. And I kind of noticed that I didn't see any other middle-aged, white, middle-class, college-educated, executive-level employed women there. And I am a card-carrying liberal, and I said to myself, they have an excuse for being here. They're underprivileged. You have no excuse for being here. And if you don't do something about your life, you're going to be back. And I didn't like it. I didn't want to come back. These same two friends who had gifted me with the big book, the one woman, of course, had had several years of Al-Anon under her belt. And when I called at 8 o'clock in the morning and said I needed to be bailed out of jail, they thought I had been drinking at 8 in the morning. And their strategy for dealing with that was to take as long as possible to get there so that I had plenty of time to think about it. So I was there for about 4 hours before I was bailed out and taken home. And I was really shaken by the process. So one of the things I did after I went to court and got everything straight squared away was to call a hospital and make an appointment, do an evaluation of whether or not they thought I was an alcoholic. And I was really worried about whether or not they were going to think I was an alcoholic. Now, as I look at that, I kind of wonder, because I hate to be late to things. I hate people who are late to things. So I wanted to be on time for this appointment. And as a result of that, I was 30 minutes early, so I went and had two double martinis while I waited. And I was worried that they were going to think that I wasn't an alcoholic. It didn't take them a real long time to figure out that I could probably qualify for the program that they were offering, and they suggested that I check in the next day. And I explained to them that I was a very busy, very important person, and that I would need time to get my affairs in order before I could do this, and that I would come back in about 5 weeks, and could we make an appointment now? And they sort of explained it didn't kind of work that way. They didn't know if they're going to have a bed in 5 weeks, that, you know, don't call us, we'll call you. Or we won't call you, you call us. I still remember how surprised Tony was when I called back 5 weeks later and went in. I was just very systematic about doing this. Once I had made up my mind that I was going to go into a hospital treatment program and let them get me sober, then I was determined to do it. I had picked September 1st as the day I was going to do it, which is a word about that later. It's not a good idea to pick a date like that. And on August 31st at 11:58 p.m., I had my last drink. And I got up the next morning and called myself a cab and went to the hospital and checked in and began this journey. It was one of those points in my life that I'm really grateful for. It was a little bit like a lot of fun in a college campus. in a dorm for 30 days with making new friends, but it was more transforming than that. I met people, alcoholics and addicts, and people that I would not normally rub shoulders with, who were just like me. And I really understood these people for the first time, partly because they seemed willing to understand me. We all sort of had the same behaviors and the same strange ways of thinking about life. And many of us had almost identical childhood experiences. There was a staff there of alcoholics, recovered people in recovery, who spent 30 days convincing me that the information I had acquired in my childhood about being unlovable and being worthless was incorrect information. They convinced me for the first time that I deserved to be alive, that I deserved to be me, and that I deserved to be loved. See, I have a little thing I have at home, one of those affirmations that says, I'm me and I'm enough. And it was in that 30 days in that hospital that I began to learn that that's a true statement. They described what they were doing. They described that process and what they were doing as something called unconditional love. The notion that what we do with other people in the world is love them because they are lovable without necessarily loving their behavior. But we love the child of God in each of us and our common humanity. I was really impressed by that whole concept, and I decided, because I was having trouble with some of this AA stuff they were giving us in the treatment facility, I decided that unconditional love could be the higher power that I had to turn my will and my life over to if I was going to get sober. And it really worked. When I began to open myself up to the possibility of that unconditional love could exist and that I could participate in it on both ends, my life really began to change, and I began to feel much more easy with the people I was sharing the planet with, which at that point in time consisted of the people I was sharing the fifth floor of the hospital with. I began to open up to the kinds of things they were telling me about what it meant to live a sober life and to be a complete human being in recovery, and to determine that I would do what they told me to do. And what they told me to do was, in my case, to go to individual therapy for 2 full years and not quit when it got hard, to work the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, to plan to go to 90 meetings in 90 days and get a sponsor, and as soon as I had 6 months of recovery, to get into service and to keep coming back, to keep showing up, and not to forget that I didn't have to drink. And that's what I took out of that 30 days in that hospital. I feel compelled from time to time in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous to point out to people in the rooms that I am one of those people from a treatment facility. Because sometimes we have an attitude about people who come from treatment facilities as though there's somehow, you know, degrees of alcoholism and there's only certain ones that we want to help. The 31 days that I spent in a treatment facility simply gave me a leg up and allowed me to do a lot of my ifs, ands, and butting in there instead of in here. So that when I came to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was ready to listen, and I was ready to participate, and I was ready to keep coming back even when I didn't want to. So I started going to meetings. The first night, first day I got out of the hospital, I went to a meeting that night. And I was nervous because I don't like situations where I don't know what's going to happen and who's going to be there and am I in the right place. So I went to this church and walked in, and I saw a 40-cup coffee maker going and heard people laughing, and I knew I was in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was greatly pleased, and my mind was eased, because one of the first people I saw when I walked in was one of those people who had brought H&R meetings into the hospital facility where I was. And from the very beginning, my life in recovery has been changed and impacted by service, most frequently by other people doing service for me. You know, sometimes we talk about what service has done for our recovery, and we always talk about what we're doing in service that has improved our recovery. And I think it's important to remember the people who are doing service to Alcoholics Anonymous and service to alcoholics are doing something for me. They're not necessarily doing it for themselves. That might be their motive, but the impact is that they helped me. I got to listen to them. I was really impressed by the variety of people who shared and the kinds of sharing and recovery that I heard in Alcoholics Anonymous. And every meeting I went to, I heard something new and wonderful that helped me grow a little bit. At 6 months of sobriety, I did what I was told to do, and I got elected secretary of my group. We were doing a co-secretarying thing. So 1 month I was the secretary, and then the next month this other woman was the secretary. And I began the process of doing my inventory on a fairly public level. I discovered that I don't do togetherness real well, and that the meeting went really well when I was secretary, but when she was secretary, the meeting went, you know, just down. She never put the cookies out in the right place. She never started the meeting on time. And what that was for me was a process of learning exactly how judgmental I was and how unwilling I am to share control of things. Shortly after that, I became a general service rep for one of my meetings, largely because there was this guy who kept going around and haranguing us that they needed GSRs, and I got sick and tired of hearing from him. Finally, I said, okay, I'll sign up. And I went to the women's candlelight meeting and said, you mind if I'm your GSR? And since they didn't know what one was, they didn't mind. So I became a general service rep. And I got involved in that process that has been central to my recovery, largely because what it did was expose me to a broader range, a different range of people. Many of those people have been sober for many, many years. Many of those people had something that they could show me how we do this thing that is the principles. When we talk about putting principles before personalities, they could show me how that was done. It wasn't just, you know, words on a page, and it wasn't just something that people talked about. I could actually see it being done and say, oh, that's what they mean. I got an opportunity to really understand what the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous was about and how important newcomers are and how important it is that all those people who were there for me when I came in still struggling with the desire to drink on a daily basis, how important it is that all of us are there for them, and that there was something that I could do to make sure that the AA that I knew when I got here was going to be here in the future, which is sort of what we do in service. And to make sure that there's money to pay for those services and all of that other dull, boring stuff that we do in general service. And I don't think it's dull and boring at all. At about 3 or 4 years of sobriety, I had what I think is probably one of my most important gifts in recovery. I had done some stuff. I had, you know, heard all this stuff about don't get involved in a relationship in your first year of recovery. And since I was a fast learner, I thought at 8 months it would be okay for me. And funny thing, it didn't work out. And I discovered then that I had a lot to learn in my own recovery and a lot of work to do for myself. And I did that work on myself for a couple of years, and things got better. And I got to a place where I was able to look at a man who was another human being who was healthy and whole. And we began a relationship that was very precious to me. And somewhere around 3 or 4 years of sobriety, he moved out of state. I lost my job. I didn't have any money. And I had a period of 6 to 8 months where I was grieving the loss of all of that. I was in a lot of pain on a daily basis because I didn't have a relationship that would help me define myself. and in which I could to some extent hide. And I didn't have a job in which I could define myself and to some extent hide. I didn't have anything except myself and the beginnings of an understanding of a relationship with a higher power who cared for me and was there to make sure that everything I needed I would get. I remember somewhere in my recovery being really impressed with an interview. I've been sponsored by lots of people who didn't know they were sponsoring me, many of them in the fellowship and some of them who had nothing to do with alcoholism, just people who seem to have some truth. And I remember being impressed by an interview that Bill Moyers did with Joseph Campbell, where at some point he asked Joe Campbell, "Do you have faith in God?" And Campbell said, "I don't need faith, I have experience." And what that period of time in my third and fourth year of sobriety did for me was gave me experience. The things I could not learn up here, I learned on a daily basis. That for a period of 6 months, what kept happening to me was that when I began to worry about tomorrow, when I began to consider whether or not life was really worth living, when I began to feel helpless and powerless over the way my life was going, that at the last minute, something would happen and everything would be okay. And about the 197th time that happened, I said, "Okay, I get it." And I had that experience of being able to go through the day knowing at the outset that everything was going to be okay. That there is a loving power, something outside myself that is a force for good and love. And that if I show up and do the footwork, that I'm going to be just fine. Because after all, I wasn't put here to prove anything to anyone. I was just sort of put here to be the very best Diane W. that the world has ever known. And it might not be the very best person that the world has ever known, or the very best General Service Conference delegate the world has ever known. But I'm the very best me that I know how to be, and on a daily basis, as long as I bear in mind that if I don't drink, it won't get screwed up. If I continue to have faith that there is a purpose and a power and a love beyond me, everything will be okay. And when I get off track, I have to go back to those 12 suggested steps and see which one I need to do some work on. And every time I do that, I get a little bit more wisdom and understanding about the way I relate to me and to the rest of the world. On my best days, I have the absolute conviction that what's really important in this life is not how much money I have or where I live or what my job is, but how I relate to the people I share the planet with and those people I know and deal with every day, and how loving I am able to be with them, and equally important, how open I'm able to be to the love that they're willing to extend to me. On my very worst days, I show up. Because you're here, and to some extent, just showing up for all of you makes me feel like it might be important to you, and I know it's important to me. Because you're my connection to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and probably more importantly, you're my connection to that force for love and good that's greater than myself. You're my connection to the thing that makes me want to stay sober, want to keep showing up. And I thank you very much for that.